The frontier always outpaces the law, Poulton said.
True, Miller agreed. But this place was already a crime scene when you got here.
Bombing the heavy shuttle was not that, Miller said.
I mean all of it. All the places.
I seem to spend a lot of time asking people to explain themselves lately. Miller laughed.
You think somebody built those towers and structures and then just left? This whole planet is a murder scene. An empty apartment with warm food on the table and all the clothes still in the closets. This is some Croatoan shit.
The North American colonists who accept, Miller said, ignoring him.
The people who vanished here? Not dumbass Europeans in way over their heads.
The things that lived here modified planets like we remodel a kitchen. They had a defense network in orbit that could have vaporized Ceres if it wandered too close.
Wait, what defense network?
Miller ignored him.
An empty apartment, a missing family. That's creepy. But this is like finding a military base with no one on it. Fighters and tanks idling on the runway with no drivers. This is bad juju. Something wrong happened here.
What you should do is tell everyone to leave.
Yeah, Poulton said. Sure, I'll get right on that.
This argument about who gets to live here really needed a third party both sides could hate.
No one lives here, Miller said. But we're sure as shit going to play with the corpses.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Miller tipped his hat back, looking up at the stars.
I never stopped looking for her.
Julie?
Even when she was dead. Even when I'd seen her body, I never stopped.
True. Still creepy, but true.
This is like that, too.
I don't like it. But unless something happens, we're going to keep reaching and reaching and reaching until we find what did all this.
And then what?
And then we'll have found it, he said.
A man Holden didn't recognize was waiting for him at the edge of town. Belter tall, stocky and thick-necked. Big meaty hands he was rubbing together nervously. Holden consciously forced himself not to drop his hand to the butt of his gun.
Thought you got lost out there, the man said.
Nope, all good. Holden held out his right hand.
Jim Holden, have we met?
Bajja. Bajja Merton from Ganymede.
Yeah, all of you are from Ganymede, right?
Pretty much.
Holden waited for the man to speak.
Bajja stared back, wringing his hands again.
So, Holden finally said, Mr. Merton, how can I help you?
You found my son back there.
You found Katoa, Bajja said.
It took Holden a moment to make the connection.
The little boy on Ganymede. Your Praxis friend.
Bajja nodded, his head moving too fast like a nervous bird.
We'd left, me and my wife and my two other kids. We got a chance to get out on the Baba Picola, and I thought Katoa was dead. He was sick, you know.
Same thing Praxis' daughter had. No immune system.
Yeah. Only he wasn't dead when we left. He was still alive in the lab where you found him.
I left my son behind.
Maybe, Holden said.
There's no way to know that.
I know that.
I know it. But I brought my family here, so I could keep them safe.
Holden nodded.
He didn't say, This is an alien world filled with dangers you couldn't possibly anticipate, on top of which you didn't actually own it, and you came here to be safe?
It didn't seem helpful.
No one can make us leave, the man finished. Well, no one can make us leave, Baja repeated. You should remember that. Holden nodded again, and after a moment, Baja turned and walked away. If that's not a member of the resistance, he at least knows who they are, he thought. Someone to keep an eye on. His hand terminal chimed an incoming connection request at him. Jim, Naomi said. There was a nervous edge to her voice. Here. Something's happening down there. Massive energy spike in your location and, movement. Chapter 15. Havelock. Slowly, New Terra was taking on a sense of familiarity. The planet's one big continent and long strings of islands turned under the Edward Israel every 98 minutes. Orbital period and the rotation of the planet conspiring to make a slightly different image every time Havelock looked. The features of the planet had started developing names for him, even though they would never be the ones that the official record showed. The largest southern island was Big Manhattan, because the outline reminded him of the North American island. The Dog's Head Islands were scattered in the middle of the planet's one enormous ocean and looked like a collie's face if he squinted. What he thought of as the worm fields were actually a massive network of rivers on the big continent, any one of them longer than the Amazon or the Nile. In the north was Crescent City, a massive network of alien ruins that sort of looked like a cartoon moon. And there, in the flat beige sweep of what he thought of as the plate, was the black dot of first landing, like the first lesion of a rash. It was tiny, but when the ship passed over it at night, it was the only spot of light. There were more places and ecosystems down there, more discoveries to make and resources to use than there had ever been on Earth. It seemed bizarre that they were fighting and dying over that one tiny piece of high desert. And it also seemed inevitable. Murtry looked out from the display, listening to Havelock's report. Gravity changed the shape of his face, pulling down at his cheeks and eyes. It actually looked pretty good on him. Some people just belonged down a well. We had one incident with Pearson Gillette.
Those are the two in marine biology?
Gillette is. Pierce is actually a soil guy. It didn't amount to anything more than a little domestic spat, but, well, tempers are fraying. All these folks came out here to work, and instead they're stuck here. We're doing sensor sweeps and dropping the occasional high atmo probe, but it's like giving starving people a cracker when they can smell the buffet. It's starting to come out at the seams a little.
That makes sense, Murtry said.
Plus which, they hate Null G. The Autodoc's been pumping out anti-nausea drugs like there's no tomorrow. I'm surprised we aren't just putting that shit in the water at this point. Murtry's smile was perfunctory. Havelock wanted to float the idea of a second colony. Maybe something in the temperate zone near a river and a beach. The kind of place someone might, for example, string up a hammock. It would let the expedition's crew get working, and the problems with the squatters could work themselves out without putting anyone else in harm's way. The words hovered at the back of Havelock's throat, but he didn't say them out loud. He already knew the arguments against it. You treated a tumor when it was small, before it spread. He could even hear it in his boss's voice. Havelock cracked his knuckles.
The shuttle? Murtry asked.
Havelock looked over his shoulder, even though he knew the office was empty apart from him. When he spoke, his voice was quieter. I got some pushback because it meant having the supply schedule, but people got over it. I thought of having the hold stacked with high-density ceramics for shrapnel and putting in a few pallets of the Geology Survey's shaped charges, but I don't have anything that's going to make a bigger explosion than the shuttle's reactor would. I've taken out all the safety overrides the way you asked, though. Physical and software. Honestly, it's a little scary going on it anymore, just knowing that it could go off.
And the controls?
The standard protocols are all stripped out. You can fly it, or I can. Anyone else is talking to a brick.
Good man.
Captain Marwick's not happy about it.
He'll cope, Murtry said. Better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
And we have the ship's drive, Pavlok said. If we pointed the Israel's ass at the Barbapicola and fired it up, we could slag it.
Right range, we could take out the Rosinante, too, Murtry said. Except that they could say the same, and they've got missiles. No, we're just getting ready for contingencies. Which brings me to the point. I've got the solution to one of your problems.
Sir?
All those bored scientists. We've lost a lot of the security team, and we're in a more hostile environment than we'd expected. I need you to do some cross-training.
You mean hire them into security?
Nothing official, Murtry said. But if we had a dozen people who were familiar with the riot gear and had some practice in low G, it wouldn't hurt my feelings.
Pavlok nodded.
A militia, then? I established that we're in de facto control of First Landing. Holden thinks he's some kind of fucking Solomon. I'm fine letting him go on with it for now, but when the time comes, we may need to put boots on the ground here. Or on the Barbapicola. I'm happy if we don't, but I want the option.
Can you do that?
Let me look into it, Pavlok said. I'm pretty sure it would mean bending corporate policy. The Home Office is pretty touchy about liability.
They sent us to the ass end of nowhere and let a bunch of squatters take their best shot at us, Murtry said. I don't particularly care what they think. It doesn't need to be official. Make it a club. Just a few folks enjoying a shared hobby for low-G tactics. Fabricate them a few paint guns. Just make sure they're ready.
In case we need them.
Right, Murtry said with his dragging, full-gravity smile. In case.
Technically, Pavlok could have spent the time in the main security office, strapped into Murtry's couch and using his desk. Instead, he tended to stick to his own familiar place beside the brig. He told himself it was because the system was already customized with his preferences and access codes, but he also knew it was more than that. Murtry had a way of claiming space even if he wasn't occupying it, and Pavlok wouldn't have been comfortable. So when the second shift ended, the chief of the engineering work group came to him at the brig. Chief Engineer Matthew Kernan was a thick man with short, bottle-brush white hair and a birthmark on his neck that he'd never bothered to have removed. He floated in the air by Havelock's couch, arms folded across his chest and legs crossed at the ankles like a dour, angry ballet dancer.
"Thank you for coming by," Pavlok said.
"They're trouble?"
Kernan snapped.
"No," Pavlok said, his voice automatically taking on the gruff tone he used when he was on duty. "I wanted to ask you about putting together a team, a dozen people for small group tactics exercises."
The chief engineer's brows furrowed and the lines around his mouth deepened. Pavlok stared him down. He'd spent too many years as a cop on too many belter stations to be intimidated by a scowl.
"Small group tactics?"
"Null G exercises," Pavlok said, "with the riot gear. Just to keep mind and body in condition."
Kernan lifted his chin, his gaze still fixed on Pavlok. It was the kind of thing a belter never did. Pavlok didn't know why the gesture so clearly belonged to someone who'd lived planetside, but it did. He found it reassuring.
"You're talking about military action? Are we expecting something?"
Pavlok shrugged against the couch restraints. The couch shifted a few millimeters on its gimbals.
"I want the option," he said, not realizing he was quoting Murtry until he'd already done it.
"Sure then. I can find another 11 people. When do you want us?"
"How long will it take?"
Kernan tapped his hand terminal with two fingertips. "I can call them right now."
Havelock smiled. We'll meet in the shuttle bay at 0700. I'll go over the equipment, and then an hour drilling every day before shift for the foreseeable future. I'll put it on the schedule. They nodded to each other, and the chief engineer put out his foot, pressing it against the face of one of the cells to launch himself to the ladder. Havelock felt something uneasy shift in his mind. He was forgetting something. Something important. When it came to him, he grunted, "Chief!" The man looked over from the ladder. The plane of his body was orthogonal to the desk, and Havelock's sense of balance shifted as his brain made one of its occasional panicked, flailing attempts to determine up from down. He closed his eyes as a wave of nausea passed over him. "Yes?" "When you pick out our team," Havelock said between clenched teeth, "no belters." For the first time, Kernan smiled. It seemed genuine. "No shit," he said. As the acting head of security, he was expected to eat in the officers' mess. It was one of those small gestures that gave the ship a sense of continuity, of rules and customs being followed, and there were some benefits for him. The lines were shorter, alcohol was available, and the wall screen was usually set to something interesting. Right now, a UN official in an uncomfortable-looking gray suit was folding his hands on a wide, glassy desk. The camera operator was framing it to be seen on hand terminals, and so the man's face was so large on the wall that Havelock could see his pores and the streaks where the technicians on Earth had dabbed on makeup. "We are at the beginning of a new golden age," he said. "The scale of this is immense. Everything we have done, from the first stone tools to the domes on Ganymede, we have done in essence with the resources of one planet, Earth. Yes, the need for minerals and rare earths took us to Mars and Luna and the Belt. And the need for infrastructure made the Jovian system much more than we had imagined. But we are looking at an expansion that is not one or two, but three orders of magnitude more than we have had in the history of our species." Havelock peeled back the foil from the top of his meal. The beef and peppers had been designed for Null G. Hard nuggets of protein and vegetable that resisted breaking apart in the air, but turned soft and pleasant in his mouth. It wasn't as sanitary as tubes of goo, but it was better eating. He popped the first cube into his mouth. It sponged up his saliva, clinging to his tongue. The camera on Earth flickered to a young, serious-faced woman. "But the designers of the protomolecule," she said, "the species who sent it here on Phoebe in the first place?" "It has been billions of years since that happened," the man in the suit said. "None of our probes have found any signs of advanced life still functioning. We have seen what appear to be ruins. We have seen what appear to be living biospheres. Honestly, there are mornings it takes my breath away." Havelock sipped at the bulb of water, and the food bloomed into a rich mouthful, almost like it had been cooked in a normal kitchen instead of an industrial processor. "So, what's the catch?" the woman said. "The catch is that the first thing we did once we got here was let a bunch of belter terrorists claim squatting rights and start shooting at us," Havelock thought as he plucked another cube from the pack. On the screen, the UN man unfolded his hands. "We are processing a bit over 4,000 applications already for the rights to explore and develop these systems. We have to do this carefully if we are to get things done right. And it does not help that the OPA has used this to make what is essentially a power grab." "Bloody belters," a voice said. Havelock turned to see Captain Marwick floating in the air behind him. The man's close-cropped red hair and beard had more gray in them than when they'd left Earth. Havelock nodded. "Do you mind if I join you, Mr. Havelock?" "Not at all," Havelock said, blinking back surprise. The captain pulled himself to the table and strapped into a crash couch. Behind him, The wall screen shifted from the UN man to the woman interviewing him, but Havelock only registered the change as shifts of lighting and background. His attention was on Marwick. "Have things been going on the surface?" the captain asked, cracking open the box containing his own dinner. He made the words seem like nothing more weighty than polite conversation. Between other people, it probably would have been. "You've seen the reports," Havelock said. "Ah, reports, though. Written for posterity and the judge, as often as not. Still, I was a bit surprised to see that our mutual friend, Mr. Murtry, had taken quite such a firm hand just when the mediator arrived." "Situation called for it," Havelock said. "We've lost a lot of good people down there by being restrained and patient." Marwick made a humming sound that could have meant anything, and ate a bite of his meal. His gaze fixed somewhere over Havelock's left shoulder. "And of course we're in a position of relative power here, aren't we?" Marwick said. "I hope our friend on the ground is keeping in mind that won't always be the case." "I'm not sure I know what you mean." "Well, I am not, strictly speaking, a part of the expeditionary force, am I? The Israel's my domain. I use my rank as captain to make the demands and requests the Home Office prefers me to. Though in truth, I'm just the lorry driver. But I'll be driving my lorry back through that gate at some point, and Fred Johnson and his well-armed base will be waiting on the other side of it. I'd rather he not think of me first and foremost as a target." Havelock chewed slowly, frowning. A dull anger tightened his jaw. "We're the ones who followed the rules here. We came with science teams and a hard dome. We hired them to build our landing platform, and they killed us. We're the good guys here." "And the moral high ground is a lovely place," Marwick said, as if he were agreeing. "It won't stop a missile, though. It won't alter the trajectory of a Gauss round. What our mutual friend does planetside has consequences that go a long way out from here. And there are those among us, myself included, who'd like to go home one day." Marwick took another bite of his dinner, smiled ruefully, and nodded as if Havelock had said something. He undid the crash couch straps. "Keeps body and soul together, these little boxes. But they don't really satisfy, do they? Give my left nut for a real steak. Well, it was a pleasure, Mr. Havelock, as always." Havelock nodded, but the anger in his chest rode the ragged edge between annoyance and rage. He knew that it was at least in part because that was the reaction Murtry would have had in his place. But knowing that didn't change the emotion. His hand terminal chimed. Chief Engineer Kernan had sent a message. He tapped it open. "We've got a full team. One of the boys is fabbing up a little logo for the club. Just something to keep morale up." Havelock considered the image. It was a stylized male form, squat and featureless, holding up a fist larger than its head. It was a cartoon of the Earther body type and of violence. Havelock looked at it for a long time before he answered back. "Looks great. Make sure you get one for me." Chapter 16, Elvie. "What do you mean, movement?" Elvie asked. "After we saw the power spike," Holden said, "the Rocinante did a sweep of the location. Several of them, actually." He held out his hand terminal and Elvie took it. She tried to look serious and not to seem impressed. She was a scientist, for God's sake, facing a serious question, not a girl who'd get on her family's shared feed and burble about how James Holden had been in her hut. She flipped the images back and forth. Human brains were wired to see movement, and so the shifting shadows were easy to spot when she went quickly. "Something's moving," she agreed. "Can we see what it is?" "Not a lot of imaging satellites up there yet," Holden said. The Rosie's built for ship-to-ship combat more than ground visualization. Anywhere in the solar system, it would have been like this. There were so many cameras of such exquisite sensitivity, almost nothing could happen in the vast emptiness inside the orbit of Neptune that couldn't be seen if someone wanted to look for it. It was another reminder of how far from home they were, and how many axioms of daily life didn't apply here. "What does the Israel see?" she asked. "Nothing that's a lot better," Holden said. "That's why we're going out. It's right at the range of the vehicles. It's going to take the better part of a day to get out there." "Why?" she asked. "I mean, I see it's decently large, but there are likely to be any number of large organisms in the ocean and colder environments."
"Organisms don't make power spikes," Holden said. "All sorts of things are moving on this planet all the time. This just started."
Elvie touched the image, expanding it until the shadows blurred. "You're right. We should check it out," she said. "Let me get my instruments." An hour later, she was in the back of an open loader, Faez at her side. Holden sat in front of them in the passenger seat while Chandra Wei drove. A vicious-looking rifle jounced at Wei's side, in easy reach if violence came on them unexpectedly. The loader's engines whined, and the wheels ground against the stones of the wide paved desert.
"Why didn't Sudyam come?"
Elvie asked, shouting to be heard over the loader and the wind. Faez leaned close to her shoulder.
"Wei thought it would be good to have someone on the Exobio workgroup still alive if this went poorly."
Elvie felt her eyes go wide, and she glanced at the woman in the driver's seat.
"Really?"
She phrased it more gently, Faez said. There was no demarcation of the border, no fence or road to show that they had left First Landing. The stone and dirt hills rose and fell, organisms like grass or fungus clinging to the land and being crushed under the loader's wheels. Slowly, the ruins that had become Elvie's landmark on New Terra thinned and shrank and fell out of view. She leaned her head against the loader's roll bar, letting the vibrations of the land translate themselves through her skull. Wei looked over her shoulder, and Elvie smiled at her. The memories of 100 field excursions in graduate school left her body expecting beer and marijuana, and the anxiety of the actual errand tugged at her. Every day for weeks, she had found some new organism or fact that humanity had never seen before. And now, she was going to something possibly even more alien. No one had said the word protomolecule, but the implication was thick as cement. Animals didn't make a power surge. The aliens did. In the wide, bright sky above them, high-altitude winds pulled a huge green and pink cloud into thin streamers. The speculation on Luna was that the strange cloud coloration meant an organism was present in them, something that packed its own minerals up into the sky and used the vapor the way salmon used spawning pools. It was only a hypothesis. The truth could be 1,000 times stranger. Or it could be utterly mundane. Elvie watched the bright fleece of cloud stretch and the sun track a little too slowly past it. Faez was typing furiously on his hand terminal. Wei drove with a focus and intensity that seemed to be her signature ever since she'd come to the surface, which meant ever since Reeve and the others had gone missing. Elvie wondered what it meant that she could go out into the absolute unknown, tracking across a planet with no idea what the local dangers might be, and it was thoughts of the people back in First Landing that frightened her. New Terra was supposed to be dangerous and wild and unknown. It was only living up to expectations. The dangers that the people posed were worse, because she hadn't seen it coming, and so she was afraid she wouldn't next time, either. She wasn't aware of drifting into a doze until Faez put his hand on her shoulder and shook her gently back to herself. He pointed up. A bright spot lit the blue of the sky like Venus seen from Earth. It grew slowly brighter as it tracked west. A thin, white contrail formed behind it, the only perfectly straight line in the organically twisting sky. A shuttle. Elvie frowned.
Were we expecting the shuttle? She asked.
That's not ours, Fayez said. That's the Barbapicola's. The mining operation's underway again.
Elvie shook her head. It was all one stupid, short-sighted mistake after another, strung together so that each one seemed inevitable. The colony would sell the ore, get lawyers, make deals. The containment dome would never be set up. What should have been clean, solid biology would turn into a salvage job of correcting for this and discarding the impurities that. Fayez seemed to know what she was thinking.
No research protocol survives contact with the subject population, he said. That's not just this. It's everything.
The sun had dipped to half a hand above the horizon when the loader topped another rise like 1,000 before it. Way braked and shut off the engines. Fayez stood up in his seat, his elbows resting on the roll bar. Holden said something obscene under his breath.
Well, Fayez said, his voice hushed. At least it wasn't hard to find.
The thing hunkered down in the depression between two hills. Its vast carapace was the nacreous white she had seen in the walls of the ruins. But there was nothing architectural about this. It had an insectile form, long, articulated limbs like legs pressing weakly out into the hard pack. Two larger appendages emerged from its back, one gray and splintered, the exoskeleton empty of anything but dust, the other swinging awkwardly. Five black circles on its abdomen recalled eyes, but didn't shift to focus on them. At least, not as far as Elvie could tell.
What is it? Wei asked.
Elvie noticed that the rifle had made its way to the woman's hands. She hadn't seen that happen.
I don't know, Elvie said. I haven't seen anything like it before.
I have, Holden said. It's one of their machines. Whatever designed the protomolecule had things like this on the station between the rings. They were smaller, though. I saw one of them kill someone.
You're telling me, Wei said, her voice even and calm, that this thing is a couple billion years old?
That would be my guess, Holden said.
Fayez whistled low.
That is not dead, which can eternal lie, or, you know, whatever.
The monster from the desert shifted drunkenly, its legs awkward, its one functioning arm twisted toward them, then collapsed to the ground. Its body shifted and trembled as it tried to lift it again.
Look, Elvie said, back there.
All along the contour line at the bottom of the valley, between hills, the stones had been scraped clean. None of the quasi-fungal grasses remained. No lizards or birds. It was like a vast hand had come down with a sponge and wiped the landscape clean. Now that she knew to look, she saw the thing's legs were pulling the native life up and feeding into tiny, chitinous orifices along its underbelly.
It's eating? She said.
On the station, Holden said. Soldiers tried to kill one with a grenade. The machines killed the man who threw it and used his body. Reprocessed it right there, turning him into paste and using him to repair the damage.
That makes sense, Elvie said.
The protomolecule repurposed biological systems during the Eros event as well.
Glad you approve, Dr. Okoye, Wei said dryly.
In your scientific opinion, could this pose a threat to the expedition?
Sure,
Maybe, Elvie said, and Holden made a gurgling sound in the back of his throat. The thing lurched forward, lost its footing, and scrambled back. It was like watching a broken toy or a car-struck dog that hadn't quite died yet. It was fascinating and frightening, and she couldn't look away. I think we need to leave now, Holden said, fear making the words come fast. Like now, not later now. Isn't what we came here for, Wei said, raising the rifle to her shoulder. What are you doing? Holden shouted. Did you not hear me about the putty making? In reply, Wei opened fire. Tracer rounds drew bright red lines through the air, and small explosions lit every place they struck. The thing staggered back, swinging its arm, but Wei pulled a fresh clip from her pocket when the first one went dry and resumed firing. The thing tried to push in toward Wei and then to move away from her. A green-gray liquid poured from the wounds in its side. The report of the rifle was deafening. The thing lurched one last time and let out a high, teeth-clenching keen. It collapsed, legs splayed in the pool of liquid. Wei let the gun's barrel drift down until it pointed at the ground. When she looked at Holden, her eyes were hard. Holden's hands were on the loader's dash, the knuckles white. His face was gray. I hope that's not a problem, sir, Wei said. You are out of your fucking mind, Holden said, his voice high and tight. That thing could have killed you. Yes, sir, Wei said. That's why I killed it. Did you? Holden said, his voice continuing to climb. Are you sure? What if it's not all the way dead? Can we burn it or something? Wei smiled. Yes, she said. Yes, we can. An hour later, the great ruddy disk of the sun touched the horizon. The flames danced around the thing's corpse, rising up higher than a bonfire. Greasy black smoke spiraled up toward the clouds, and the whole world seemed to reek of accelerants. Wei had taken a small tent from the loader's storage, and fires had set it up. Elvie stood, the heat of the sun and the fire pressing against her face. The night was going to be long. They all were, here. You all right? Fires asked. I'm fine. I wish I'd gotten some samples, though. In the heart of the fire, the thing glowed. Its shell was white hot, and thin cracks had started to show, radiating out from its joints. It was beautiful in its way, and she was sorry to see it destroyed and relieved in almost equal measures. It wasn't an emotional mixture she was used to. Wei insisted on setting up watches through the night, and Holden volunteered to take the first of them. He seemed uneasy in a way that Elvie wouldn't have thought James Holden, captain of the Rocinante, was capable of. Vulnerable. Elvie lay in the tent, her head poking out. Faez snored softly beside her. Wei, curled in the back of the loader with a thin blanket, was silent as stone. Elvie watched Holden and listened while he hummed to himself. A lonely, human sound in the vast, inhuman planet. Sleep didn't come. After 2 hours, she gave up, rose from her uncomfortable bed, and went to sit at the man's side. In a world without moonlight, there was only the orange glow of the alien's dying pyre and a thin, silver highlight of stars. It reduced him to a few lines and a sense of mass and warmth. I couldn't sleep, she said. I don't think I will either, he said. I hate the way those things scare me. I'm surprised to hear you say that. You were expecting me to enjoy it? She could hear the smile. Far above them, a falling star streaked across the sky, bright and then gone. I'm not used to hearing men admit to having emotions, she said. You were on Eros when the outbreak came, weren't you? I'd think after that, nothing would frighten you.
Doesn't work that way. After Eros, everything frightened me. I'm still trying to calm down.
He chuckled.
When he spoke again, his voice had sobered.
Do you think that thing was a machine? Or was that an animal?
I don't think that's a distinction they would have made.
You mean the designers?
Who the hell knows how they would have seen anything?
Oh, we can say some things, Elvie said.
What they cared about was in what they designed, and still is, in a way. We know that they respected the power of self-replicators, and knew how to harness it.
She felt him turn toward her more than saw it. She was profoundly aware of being a woman in a dark wilderness with a man beside her. It made the vast night seem intimate.
How do we know that? He asked.
Where they sent the protomolecule, she said, the universe has some things that are fairly consistent. The elements are all the same. Carbon is always carbon. Nitrogen's always nitrogen. They make the same bonds and can build the same structures. All the systems we've surveyed have at least one planet that has the possibility of generating organic replicators.
Meaning things with DNA?
Or things that act like DNA. They sent out bridge builders to use those basic biological replicators, whatever their form. They can take a biosphere and turn it into a massively networked factory. It's probably how they spread. Target the places that can be hijacked into making the things that let you get there. Also, they really built structures to last. They seem to have taken the long view on galactic colonizing.
She leaned back, letting her hand rest on the front of the loader. Not reaching out to him, but putting her fingers where, in the darkness, he might accidentally brush against them. To the north, some small animal called, its voice high and chirping.
It was there for billions of years, Holden said, and we killed it with a rifle and some mineral spirits. In our defense, it wasn't looking healthy. But yes, it wasn't expecting anything as advanced or as aggressive as we are. They built structures that lasted billions of years. The ruins, that thing, the rings, all of it.
They sound like gods sometimes. Angry, spiteful gods, but still.
No, Elvie said. Just organisms that we don't understand. And with their own constraints. They were specialized for their ecosystem just like we are. 1300 worlds seems a lot when you've only ever had the one. But it's a raindrop in the ocean compared with what's out there, just in our galaxy.
They had more.
Elvie made a small, inquiring sound.
They had more, Holden said. But something attacked them, and they tried to stop it. They burned up entire solar systems, a lot of them. Then, when that didn't work, they shut down the whole network. Quarantined themselves and died anyway.
I didn't know that.
I saw it. Sort of. A guy I used to know is kind of looking into it.
I'd like to talk to him, she said.
Yeah, he's less helpful than you'd expect.
Wei shifted in her sleep. Elvie yawned, though she wasn't particularly tired.
Why did it wake up? He said, nodding toward the alien corpse. Was it because of us? Did it know we were here?
Maybe, she said.
Or maybe they cycle up and down every so often.
We've only seen one. There may be a lot of these, and seeing them will be common. There may be a few, and it will be rare. There could only have been one.
Not enough data yet.
I guess not.
Still, I wish I knew what was going to happen.
I don't. So much of my life has been better than what I imagined. I've come to enjoy being surprised. When I was doing my undergraduate at Kano, I was imagining I'd be doing environmental essays on Europa for my whole career. Instead, this.
Kano?
I spent a lot of time in the West African Shared Interest Zone when I was growing up. Northern Nigeria. I went back there for university. Really? Holden said, his voice bright. One of my fathers had family in Nigeria.
One of them?
I have several, he said. Extended parental group.
Oh, I've heard of those.
Makes for a big nuclear family and a huge extended one. We might be cousins.
I hope not,
Elvie said, laughing, and then wished she could suck the words back. The silence was terrible. She couldn't see his face clearly, but she could imagine it. The surprise, the embarrassment. She pulled her hand back and put it in her lap.
He said. If you'd like, I'll take the rest of the watch, Elvie said.
The lightness in her voice sounded forced, even to herself.
I don't think I'll be sleeping much tonight anyway.
That would be great, Holden said.
Thank you.
Just be careful of Faez. He steals the blankets.
James Holden slid off the loader.
She heard his footsteps tracking back to the tent, heard the rustle of the plastic as he bedded down. She hunched over, arms around her belly. The thing from the desert was nothing more than embers, glowing dull orange in the night but illuminating nothing. The humiliation sat with her, bright and painful as a paper cut.
Stupid, she said softly. Stupid, stupid, stupid.
The alien darkness didn't disagree. Chapter 17. Baja. Coop and Kate had been old-school OPA back when the Outer Planets Alliance was just a shared opinion with guns. They'd come up the ranks together, even when wearing the OPA split circle on your sleeve was an arrestable offense. They'd learned their craft sneaking past armed Earth-Mars Coalition checkpoints, planting bombs, smuggling guns, and generally acting like the terrorists the Inner Planets had accused them of being. The only reason they hadn't both gone to prison camps forever was because, by some standards, the OPA had won. After Eros, the Inner Planets had begun treating the OPA like an actual government, and many of the OPA warriors had received the de facto amnesty that non-enforcement brought. Kate was just a minor now, like the rest of them, but she could use words like tactical advantage and actually sound like she knew what she was talking about. The terrain and numerical superiority are our tactical advantages, Kate said to the small group assembled in her house, but we're outgunned. No way around that. We have maybe a dozen firearms total. We can still get explosives, but the deal Holden struck with the RCE makes it much riskier.
Fucking Holden, Zadie said.
We'll deal with him soon enough, Kate replied. Her audience was made up of the usual gang. Zadie's son had taken a turn for the worse with his eye infection, and her wife was staying home with him full time now. Baja had the impression that Zadie was looking for someone to punish for her family's pain. Pete, Scotty, and Ibrahim were there as well, the veterans of their one skirmish with the RCE security people. It gave them a degree of status in the group that they'd latched onto. But there were a few new people as well. Other members of the colony who might have been on the fence before about the best way to deal with RCE, but had been pushed into the revolutionary camp by Murtry's brutal tactics, by the martyring of Coop.
How, Scotty asked, how do we deal with Holden?
I think we remove all of our problems in one multi-front operation, Kate said. Murtry and his team, Holden and his thug, everyone at once. The key to this kind of war is money.
Make us too expensive to occupy, Ibrahim nodded. He'd been OPA too.
Exactly. That's how we got the Inners off our asses in the belt. If it's not economically viable to occupy us, they won't. Every one of them that goes home in a body bag is one more nail in the corporate coffin.
Kate punched one large fist into her other hand to punctuate.
I don't follow. How does killing them help us with that? Baja asked. He'd agreed to come in hope he might be able to help cooler heads prevail. That was looking less and less likely the longer the meeting went on.
It's an 18-month trip to send new troops to the front, Kate answered. That's a long-flight freighter tied up for over 3 years. That's expensive. And for the year and a half they're flying out here, we're fortifying our position, making camps in the hills, branching out. In order to win, they'll need to do a full military program. Medina Station won't support that, even if they get pissed at us for pushing the issue.
Coercive alliance, Ibrahim added, nodding.
By the book, Kate said. The room was quiet for a moment as everyone there mulled over her words. The metal roof rattled and scraped as the wind outside blew sand across it. The windows creaked, cooling with the night. A dozen people breathed the alien air.
They're here already, Baja said, clearing his throat to break the silence.
Isn't that exactly what they'll do?
What who will do? Scotty asked.
The Rocinante, Baja replied. They're in orbit right now. A warship with guns and missiles and who knows what else. If we kill Holden, can't they just bomb us?
Let's hope they do, Kate thundered at him.
By God, let's hope so. A few videos of dead colonists murdered by UN ships in orbit and the public opinion war is over.
Baja nodded as though he were agreeing, while what he was really thinking was, I'm on the wrong team.
So, we move on both groups at once, Kate said. Her voice had taken on the same cadence as Coop used to have. It was as if the man were still in the room, haunting the place. They keep 2 people on roving patrol at all times, so we'll need a team shadowing them until the signal goes out. We'll put a 2nd team on the security building where Murtry and the rest of his people will be. The 3rd team will go to the commissary where Holden and his crewmen are holed up at night. I'm thinking Scotty and Ibrahim for Team 1. I'll lead. Kate rattled on, laying out the insanity of multiple murder like a puzzle to be solved or a game to be won. Coordinating the attack so all 3 happened at once, so no one could raise the alarm. Using phrases like fields of fire and maximum aggression, as if they meant anything other than gunning down 12 women and men while most of them slept. The little group nodded and followed along. Baja was astonished by how easily the unthinkable became the routine. My children live here, Baja said, interrupting.
What? Kate said, looking genuinely puzzled.
She'd been mid-sentence when he spoke up.
I don't...
The bodies that we take pictures of to send to the newscasts, Baja continued. Those are our children. My children.
Kate blinked at him, too puzzled to be angry yet.
Como?
I wanted to come here and maybe talk you out of doing something stupid, Baja said, standing up and addressing the room. I thought maybe with Coop gone, we could put an end to this. But this isn't just stupid anymore. Not when you can talk about dead friends and family as media tools. That's evil, and I can't be part of it.
The room was silent again, except for the sand and the cooling windows and the breathing.
If you try to get in our way, Ibrahim started, but Baja wheeled to face the man.
What? He said, getting close enough that his breath stirred the whiskers in Ibrahim's thin beard.
If I get in your way, what? Don't make half a threat, macho.
Ibrahim was smaller than him. He lowered his eyes and said nothing. Baja felt a brief moment of shameful relief that it was Ibrahim who had chosen to press the issue, not Kate. Baja was afraid of Kate. He'd never have been able to stand up to her.
Doi, he said, backing away and nodding to them all.
Gone now.
They began talking in hushed tones after the door closed behind him, but he couldn't hear what they were saying. It made the back of his neck itch. He wondered if he'd gone too far, and if they'd be content with just killing him and not Lucia too.
Halfway home, he ran into two of the RCE security people walking patrol. Two women in heavy body armor that made them look bulky and dangerous. One of them, a fair-skinned woman with raven black hair, nodded at him as he walked past. Everything about her was a threat. The armor, the large assault rifle she cradled in her arms, the stun grenades and wrist restraints hanging on her belt. Her friendly smile looked wildly out of place. Baja couldn't stop himself from picturing her bleeding out in the street, shot in the back by one of his friends. Lucia was waiting on their porch, sitting cross-legged on a large pillow and drinking something that steamed in the night air. Not tea. They had almost none of it left. Probably just hot water with a bit of lemon flavoring. But even the artificial flavorings would soon be gone unless they were given permission to begin trading their ore. Baja sat down on the hard carbon fiber floor next to her with a thump.
So? Lucia asked.
They won't listen, Baja sighed. They're talking about killing the RCE people. All of them. And Jim Holden and his people, too.
Lucia shook her head, a gentle negation.
And you? At this point, they may be talking about killing me, too. I don't think they will, as long as I don't get in their way. But I can't take part. I told them so. I'm so sorry I let it get this far, Lucy. I'm a very stupid man.
Lucia gave him a sad smile and put her hand on his arm.
Not doing anything now keeps you on their side.
Baja frowned. The night air still held the earthy smell of the recent dust storm. A graveyard scent.
I can't stop them by myself. Holden is here to do that. He's back from whatever he was doing out in the desert with the science teams. You could talk to him.
I know, Baja said, admitting what he'd already been thinking. The fact that it was necessary didn't make it feel like any less of a betrayal of his friends.
I know. I will.
Lucia laughed to relief. At Baja's puzzled look, she grabbed him in her arms and pulled him close.
I'm so happy to know that the Baja I love is still in there.
Baja relaxed into her embrace, letting himself feel safe and loved for a moment.
Baj,
Lucia whispered in his ear.
Don't say anything that will ruin this moment, he thought.
Felcia is leaving on the shuttle for the Baba Piccola. Now. Tonight. I gave her permission.
Baja pulled himself away, holding Lucy at arm's length.
She's doing what? Lucia frowned at him and gripped his upper arms tightly.
Let her go.
There was a warning in her voice. Baja pulled himself free and leaped to his feet. Lucia called after him, but he was already running down the road toward the landing site as fast as his legs would carry him. His relief when he saw the shuttle still sitting there was so powerful he almost collapsed. One of the colony's electric carts whizzed by, nearly running him over in the dark. The bed of the cart was filled with ore. They were still loading the shuttle. He had time. Felcia stood a few meters from the airlock, a suitcase in each hand, chatting with the pilot. They were in a bright pool of illumination cast by the worklight surrounding the ship, and her dark olive skin seemed to glow. Her black hair hung about her face and down her back in loose waves. Her eyes and mouth were wide as she spoke on some topic that excited her. In that moment, his daughter was so beautiful, it made Baja's chest ache. When she spotted him, her face lit up with a smile. Before she could speak, Baja wrapped her in his arms and squeezed her tight. Papa? She said, worry in her voice.
No, baby. It's okay.
He shook his head against her cheek.
I didn't come to stop you. I couldn't let you leave without saying goodbye.
His cheek felt wet. Felcia was crying.
He held her by the shoulders and pushed her away to look at her face. His little girl, all grown up but crying in his arms. He couldn't help but see the 4-year-old she'd once been, weeping.